This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. It's National Rebuilding Month, where volunteers help provide safe and healthy homes for low-income Americans across the country. The month-long call to service was created by the national nonprofit Rebuilding Together in 2010. Last April, more than 50,000 individuals were involved in over 3,000 affiliate-led rebuild projects.
We're really trying to provide the homeowner with a way to age in place.
Virginia Williams is the AmeriCorps project coordinator with Rebuilding Together for Pitt County.
You can drive out in any direction in the county and notice just the level of disparity. We find a lot of homeowners who are elderly, and that is really where we try to step in. It's people who may not be able to afford living in retirement communities, but their house is falling down around them.
This weekend, local volunteers will reach out and help remodel three homes in Pitt County. All of the home improvements will be done at no cost to the homeowners.
We have a class at ECU. They're an interior design class. They're helping us with this particular house to provide those repairs. We also are doing two other homes on this day, and we have 11 Marines coming in from Jacksonville to volunteer for the day. They will be painting a room. They will be creating a hole for a dryer so that it can vent outside properly.
Each year, Rebuilding Together Pitt County does two large building projects, one in the spring and one in the fall. Since 2008, the nonprofit has provided critical damage repair and safety modification repairs for 19 homes and three nonprofit facilities.
One of our programs is called Safe at Home, and that deals with fall prevention strategies and modifications in a home. So falls are the leading causes of death in adults over 65.
The Safe at Home program focuses specifically on modifications to bathrooms. Grab bars are installed in the tub and around the toilet, and handheld shower heads and shower stools are provided. Homes are also checked for working smoke detectors, carbon monoxide detectors, and fire extinguishers. One aspect of the Safe at Home program involves training the homeowners on how to use the new equipment. All three homes during this weekend's build event will benefit from safety improvements. But Williams says a house that belongs to an elderly woman in Pitt County will receive special attention because of the homeowner's history of community service.
She was a teacher and a Girl Scout leader, and she continues to volunteer in after-school programs.
Her home will be outfitted with new ductwork and a completely redesigned bathroom so she can use a walker in the space.
For a woman who's given back and given so much to the community, I'm very excited to be helping her and giving back a little bit to her.
To receive services from Rebuilding Together, William says an application must be submitted. Elderly, disabled, and low-income homeowners who are not able to do the work themselves and nonprofit facilities are eligible to receive services.
We do ask for financial evidence. For people who qualify, it is based off of finances. We are looking at the 50% median income bracket following HUD guidelines.
Rebuilding Together Pitt County also installs wheelchair ramps and makes energy-efficient modifications to homes. If you qualify, an application can be found online at rebuildingtogetherpittcounty.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Many of the political ads you see and hear are produced by independent third-party interest groups. They're called independent because it's illegal for these groups and candidates to coordinate their campaigns. But this year, it's harder to distinguish between these groups and some candidates in North Carolina's U.S. Senate race. WFAE's Tom Bullock reports the campaigns of Tom Tillis and Kay Hagan are pushing the boundaries of election law.
If you haven't seen this ad yet, there's a good chance you will. It's scheduled to run more than 400 times in Charlotte alone over the next 2 weeks.
Who's behind the attacks on Kay Hagan? Oil industry billionaires, that's who.
The ad begins with ominous shots of refinery smokestacks, all the color missing from the scene. Then, like the Wizard of Oz, it transitions to color and scene after scene of Kay Hagan smiling, reading, talking with younger and older people alike. But Hagan's campaign did not produce this ad. A clean energy advocacy group based out of Knoxville did. It's called the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Stephen Smith is their executive director.
We are spending just a little bit less than $1 million on the ads running in the three major media markets in North Carolina.
The ad runs for 30 seconds, and half of its footage was produced by Hagen's campaign for a different ad, one of their own.
When I first ran for office, I came from the private sector as a working mom looking to make a difference for middle-class families.
The voiceover and music are different, but the scenes are exactly the same. Kay Hagen smiling, breathing, talking with younger and older people alike. Below this post on the website is a big red button that says, "Download video." Stephen Smith of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy freely admits his group got the footage of Hagen from Hagen's campaign.
My understanding is candidates can now put up generic B-roll footage that is available for any party to use to sort of show her activities as a representative.
And here is where a new campaign tactic that may run afoul of election law comes into play. By law, candidates and outside groups are banned from coordinating with each other. But it's not hard for these groups to figure out what a candidate wants, says Dale Eisman, a lead writer and spokesman for Common Cause, a national campaign watchdog group.
One sort of knows what the other wants, sometimes simply by watching the news reports and seeing what the candidate is talking about today or this week or what themes he or she's emphasizing.
The use of B-roll, that generic footage of candidates that can easily be repurposed by outside groups, crosses party lines. Tom Tillis, one of the Republicans vying for Hagen's seat, has a perfect example of B-roll conveniently posted on his YouTube page. It's called Montage 2, and that's a fitting name. There are no words, no voiceover, no captions or promises or position statements. Not even a Tom Tillis approves this message. There is no message at all. It's just 2 minutes and 54 seconds of, "Hey, there's Tom Tillis walking through a generic office. Tillis now talking to a businesswoman and her male colleague. Tillis now in a business meeting. Tillis walking down the street with his wife." Kay Hagen also has a similar B-roll production buried on her campaign website.
One might credibly argue that posting B-roll footage on your website is a suggestion to outside groups that they create ads supporting your candidacy.
Paul Ryan is senior counsel at the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C.
It's hard to imagine another purpose for candidates putting B-roll footage on their own websites other than suggesting that outside groups run ads.
In other words, that suggestion could be de facto coordination. Calls and emails to the Tillis campaign asking why they posted B-roll, what it accomplishes for the campaign, or who they hoped might use it, went unanswered. Similar requests to Kay Hagen's campaign were answered only in a statement that read, in part, "It's out of our control how groups might use that footage for or against us." Both major political parties have levied complaints about outside groups republishing materials such as B-roll footage. Three of the six members of the Federal Election Commission have ruled this kind of republishing is permissible. But that doesn't mean the FEC approves, says Bob Lenhart, who chaired the FEC in 2007.
It's a controversial view because there are three commissioners who believe that it is in fact a violation of the agency's regulations and the statute prohibiting republication of a campaign's material.
A tie at the FEC just means the group is deadlocked and the issue remains unresolved. Lenhart now practices election and political law in Washington, D.C., and he's advised candidates before. So I asked him this hypothetical question. Would you tell a candidate today that it is legal to produce B-roll footage for use in ads by outside groups? There was a long pause, and then Lenhart did the lawyerly thing to do.
I'll answer the question, a somewhat different question, but I think it takes us to a similar point, which is I think that campaigns at this point can comfortably feel that if they do put their B-roll footage on publicly available websites, there are not four votes at the FEC to find that a violation of the law.
His answer, like the law, is open to interpretation.
This is the Down East Journal. The NOAA Lab in Beaufort is involved with collecting and analyzing data on marine mammal species, assessing fish stocks, and working to understand the Atlantic ecosystem. But this important local institution for marine science discoveries could soon close. The Department of Commerce has requested the lab to be shut down as a cost-cutting measure when they outlined their budget for fiscal year 2015. As a result of the closure, years of research could stop and more than 100 jobs at the Beaufort lab cut. Public Radio East's Mac McKee speaks with former employee Pat Tester about the contributions of the NOAA lab to the marine science community.
The NOAA lab is uniquely situated, you might say, at the intersection of northern and southern fish species. Now, at present, it's the only lab that I know of. It's the sole governmental research center between, say, New Jersey and Miami. In your time at NOAA Marine Lab in Beaufort, can you tell us a little bit about what its original purpose was when it was established?
Yes, it was established in 1899 by the U.S. Fish Commission. They provided the first funding for the laboratory there and the science that it did. And they had the charge to understand the factors affecting regional fisheries.
Now, how important overall is your belief, in your opinion, is marine science to the economy of Carteret County in eastern North Carolina?
Actually, the Economic Development Council did some work on this a few years back, and they estimated that marine science throughout the county employs more than 500 people and injects about $58 million into the local economy. So that's quite a bit. And out of the NOAA fisheries facility, we have about 100 employees on staff there.
Is there any other facility that could engage in vital oceanic research apart from the NOAA lab on Pivers Island?
It is the uniqueness of this location with the northern province ending at Hatteras and the southern province coming up to Hatteras that gives us the most diverse region in the U.S. and also the habitat from the freshwater through our estuaries across the coastal region out into the open ocean and the Gulf Stream is one of the most diverse habitats as well. So it's a unique situation for fishery science. And in order to do the best work that we can do, we need to be in proximity with these regions. It's also an area where we would anticipate the changes, the variabilities in our habitats to be seen early on. So it's sort of a sentinel location, if you will.
So this laboratory is essential not only for preserving our fisheries and basically the ecology of the waterways itself, it's also essential for the tourism industry too.
Yes. In order to keep our coastline as healthy as it can be, we do vital research also in submerged aquatic vegetation. And to keep these habitats functional, we need to know what's happening to them. We need to be in the proximity of these habitats.
What would you say the overall legacy has been for the NOAA lab over the years?
I think it's been the nexus of the marine science community in that it was established first, supported a number of graduate students through the years before State University had its laboratory over in Morehead City. We serve sort of as the surrogate laboratory for graduate students here. And it's the local and regional collaborations that we've fostered in our long history and the fisheries work that we've done. The staff is easily responsible for the successful management and recovery of important snapper grouper fisheries. It's the ecology that we've done on many of the commercial species throughout the Southeast. We have looked at invasive lionfish, and we have a very aggressive research program involved with that. I think it's our ability to be in the right location as things happen so that we can begin to understand what is happening and how that might change management strategies.
Pat, thank you so much for being a part of Downey's Journal today.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I think there's every good reason to think that our laboratory will be there for many years to come.
A groundbreaking study into what may cause ALS was recently released by a researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. According to ScienceDaily.com, scientists pinpointed an error in protein formation that could be the root of ALS. Commonly referred to as Lou Gehrig disease, ALS is a progressive degenerative disease that affects nerve cells in the brain and the spinal cord. Raising funds for ongoing research is part of the reason for next weekend's Down East Walk to Defeat ALS in Greenville. The nonprofit Jim Catfish Hunter chapter hopes to educate the public with the event, which will raise money to help fund research and connect families who are affected by the disease. Michael Peterson has more.
According to the ALS Association, approximately 5,600 people in the U.S. are diagnosed with ALS each year. The incidence of ALS is 2 per 100,000 people. As many as 30,000 Americans have the disease at any given time. The beginning stages of ALS include muscle weakness in the hands, arms, legs, or mouth. Symptoms may include thick speech, difficulty projecting, trouble swallowing or breathing, and cramping of muscles in the hands and feet. In more advanced stages, motor neurons die, causing impeded muscle movement. Motor control loss eventually leads to paralysis.
It's an ugly, suffering disease, and I would love to see the day where no one else has to suffer from it.
Development coordinator Laura Cowan from the ALS Association's Jim Catfish Hunter chapter explains the challenges people with ALS face every day.
You lose your ability to use your arms and legs. That ability is not going to return. No matter how much physical therapy, your body is not going to be able to walk again or lift your hand up again or grip something. So a lot of the challenges that come with ALS are just adapting to what can sometimes be day-to-day changes. We often say that with ALS, you're looking to find a new normal. Each day can be a little bit different in terms of how ALS has changed your body.
There is a known hereditary factor that occurs in families with ALS, but in most cases, ALS has no known cause. New research has found an increased risk of ALS in U.S. veterans and those who've experienced head trauma or head injury through contact sports. June Thompson founded the ALS Association's North Carolina chapter in 1987 to help ALS patients and caregivers. In 2002, the group renamed itself the Jim Catfish Hunter chapter, paying tribute to the North Carolina baseball hero who died of the disease in 1999 at age 53.
Jim Catfish Hunter is from Hertford, North Carolina, which is kind of in the northeastern part of the state, and he was a Major League Baseball player. He actually played for the Yankees, which is also who Lou Gehrig played for. And Catfish Hunter had ALS, and so when our chapter was getting started, we took his name for the name recognition because we have people who are involved with the walk solely because they grew up in the era of watching Catfish Hunter, and that's how they learned about ALS.
Hunter was the first pitcher since 1915 to win 200 games by age 31. He retired in 1979 after developing persistent arm problems. He was diagnosed in his early 50s. For 10 years, the Down East Walk to Defeat ALS event has supported the nonprofit group's research to find a cure for ALS. Development coordinator Laura Cowan says anyone can participate in the walk, which is only 2 miles.
It's handicap accessible, and we have some vendors on hand who can help assist with a motorized wheelchair to use for the walk if you need to. And it's a paved trail, and leashed animals are welcome, children are welcome, strollers. Bring your family and your friends for a really fun morning.
The group hopes to raise $75,000. Cowan tells us the money will be used for care management, medical equipment loan program, support groups, and ALS research.
We also have statewide sponsors and national sponsors, but the bulk of the funds raised at the Down East Walk come from family teams who maybe have had someone pass away from ALS over the years, or maybe they know someone who is living with the disease right now, and they've chosen to honor that person by raising money and coming out to the walk.
More teams mean a better opportunity for fundraising and increased awareness of ALS. The Down East Walk to Defeat ALS will take place April 12th at Alice F. Keene Park in Greenville. Walk check-in begins at 8:30 and the walk starts at 10 a.m. If you want to find out about next weekend's event, go to webmc.alsa.org. You can also find a link at our website, publicradioeast.org. Just look for this story. I'm Michael Peterson.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Orthopedics East and Sports Medicine Center, specializing in the treatment of sports injuries, arthroscopic surgery and rehabilitation, on-site physical therapy, and MRI, located at 810 W.H. Smith Boulevard, Greenville, and online at orthoeast.com.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. It's getting on to spring now, although on some days it really doesn't feel like it, and yes, I'm tired of it too. But as spring comes along, it's ground nesting bee time again. I'm not talking about yellow jackets, those are wasps, but ground nesting bees. These are the solitary bees that make individual nests in sparse, thin lawns that are dry. Sometimes hundreds of these bees will be nesting in one site, and you'll see them flying about a few inches over the top of the soil. This can make homeowners really nervous, but there's no need to be. Let me tell you a little bit about these bees that was provided to our Extension office from Steve Frank, the Extension entomologist at North Carolina State University. After you understand the bees, you'll understand that the risk of being stung is very low, and maybe enjoy watching them in your yard rather than being afraid. I mentioned that these are solitary bees. That means that they do not maintain big hives with hundreds of workers like honeybees or yellow jackets do. Instead, a single female bee builds a nest by burrowing in the ground. You know those little piles you see all over the yard, tiny ones? Those are where a bee has either burrowed into the ground to lay eggs or where newly hatched bees have emerged from the ground. A single female bee will prepare cells where her eggs will be laid. She'll put a mixture of pollen and nectar called bee bread in to serve the young larvae when they emerge. After laying the eggs, she closes one cell and starts another. After completing several brood cells, the mother bee will seal that entrance and move to a new spot to start a new nest. She only lives a few weeks and dies, leaving the eggs safe in the ground. In spring of the next year, the bees complete development and emerge as adults that dig their way out of the ground and look for pollen and nectar to provision their own new nest. That's what you're seeing now. These are the new bees emerging to start this year's cycle. What you see flying over the ground, sometimes hundreds in what looks like circles a few inches above these mounds, well, that's the male bees. They're looking for newly emerged females that they can mate with. And those male bees, well, they don't have stingers at all. And what about the female bees? Well, these female bees all use their ovipositors to lay eggs. Unlike honeybees, where only the queen lays eggs, and all of the worker bees have modified ovipositors that work as stingers to protect the hive. Now, these ground bee females are able to sting, but their stingers aren't as highly developed, and they rarely do. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't torture them to the point where you might be stung, but generally, if you're just doing your normal yard things while they're outside, you're not going to be bothered. And to answer your next question, no, the bees are not harming your lawn. That's not to say that your lawn is not in trouble. If the bees are there, it's because your vegetation, your grass, is very thin and weak, and your area is very dry. The bees didn't cause this. They're just taking advantage of it. If you want your lawn to be less appealing to ground bees in the future, do everything you can to make your grass healthier. Think about proper irrigation, deeply, once or twice at the most a week, rather than light irrigation daily. And make sure you manage your grass properly for maximum growth. So if you see ground bees in your lawn or another over the next few weeks, just look at them as a sign that spring is coming and appreciate the fact that there's something that reflects spring this year. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.